The Fan on Demand.
You're listening to Sportsnet Radio, The Fan 590. It's Aces, Canada's only regular tennis show right here on Sportsnet Radio, The Fan 590. I'm Roger Lajoie, joined by Tom Tebbutt, veteran tennis writer and, of course, co-host here throughout the course of the season. Tom, great to see you, my friend.
Rog, great to be back.
Hey, listen, we're going to get right away to an interview with Tony Cho, referee of the Rogers Cup. But quickly, your thoughts on the Rogers Cup, Tom? We haven't talked in a little while. I thought a great tournament in both Montreal and Toronto.
Well, it was fantastic in Montreal. Obviously, the top player in the world, Novak Djokovic, played great. And in Toronto, really, we got the best woman player in the world. But a little bit of attendance problems in Toronto could have been a little bit better. But on the whole, I think when you get the best player winning, it kind of ends it on the right note.
Best players need best referees. Tom had a chance to catch up with the referee of the Rogers Cup, Tony Cho.
Tony Cho, welcome to Aces.
Thank you very much, Tom. Glad to be here.
Tony Cho, you're the referee of the Rogers Cup, and you do a lot of tournaments around the world. What does a referee do, actually? How would you be different from the umpire at a tournament?
Well, basically, there is one referee that handles everything, and then there are lots of chair umpires and off-the-line umpires. So I'm actually responsible for all the officiating that happens during the tournament week, as well as all the problems with players. So pretty much it's problem-solving for the players all week.
And how did Tony Cho become a referee? Were you an umpire first?
Yes, I was actually. I started back in 1986. I think it was called the Players Limited, right, Tom?
Yeah, something with Players International or Players Challenge.
Yeah, Players International or something like that. It was back in 1986. I started off as a line umpire. I think it was in 1985 I went to see the tennis tournament, and I got to see Gabriela Sabatini play, and then I was hooked after that.
So are you saying you just wanted to be an umpire or eventually a referee so you could get close to the women players?
Well, initially started like that a little bit, I guess, like everybody else. I was very, very young at that time. And I started off as a line umpire and then kept it up as a line umpire and then went to university. After I finished university, the part-time job became a full-time job when the ATP Tour offered me a job as a full-time chair umpire. So from about 1992 or so, I traveled about 6 years on the ATP Tour as a full-time chair umpire, so that was kind of fun. And then after that, I worked a little bit at Tennis Canada, developing all the officiating program. And then now I'm working for the WTA Tour as a full-time supervisor.
And how do you evolve from an umpire into a referee or a supervisor?
Well, I think it actually gives you a good vantage point to start, in essence, right at the bottom as a line umpire, because you can kind of see the progression as a line umpire. As a line umpire, you support the chair umpire, so the chair umpire can overrule you. And as a chair umpire, you're supported by the referee, and the referee can overrule chair umpire's decisions on anything to do with the rules. So as I saw every aspect of the officiating, it actually helps me a lot as a referee as well.
And what would you say your biggest crisis was during last week's Rogers Cup?
Well, I guess the biggest crisis was a lot of some of the weather issues that we had, obviously. That was kind of interesting. But the biggest challenge that I actually had was a near miss. In essence, I think you heard about the situation where we had the lights on grandstand court.
Mm-hmm.
It was during the Ivanovic singles match, and one of the light covers actually fell off. It was a big, huge glass piece fell off in the corner of the court. So during the match, mid-match, it actually hit almost hit one of the ball kits. So we had to decide whether the court was fit to play or not. I decided actually, obviously, not to play on that court based on the fact that it was kind of a windy day and we weren't sure if other light fixtures were going to fall or not. So we actually had to close that court down, bring in a big forklift to make sure that all the lights were checked. And about 2.5 hours later, we put that court back into play again. So that caused a few problems.
Right, so did Ivanovic finish the match on that court?
No, she did not. We had to wait on court number one to finish. So she waited for another match to finish. We moved that match to court number one, and Ivanovic finished on court number one.
I see. And how has Hawkeye changed things for you as a referee or for the chair umpires who are actually working the matches?
It's changed immensely. One of the biggest things, I guess, you know, when I was a chair umpire, I think in the 90s, I came up with Agassi, Sampras, Courier, all those guys. And the biggest problem we always had was line calls. It was all this discussion, nonstop discussion about line calling, whether the chair umpire was right, whether the line umpires are right. So that whole equation has been now taken out of play, in essence, because with Hawkeye, the players have accepted it as being 100% correct. So all that discussion back and forth in a match doesn't happen anymore. So that's actually made it and made the game progress quicker and a match progress quicker, as well as taking out a lot of that, you know, back and forth of the player in regards to line calls. It's actually, I think, helped tennis a lot.
Right. And there's obviously some concern now with time between points and talk even of having sort of a clock on the court counting down to the number of seconds that a player has left before they have to start the next point. How do you feel about that?
Well, it's a little bit tricky, I think, just because we're obviously talking about changing the rules a little bit, because I'm pretty sure you know this. The ATP Tour allows 25 seconds between points, and the Grand Slams actually only allow 20 seconds between points. So we're actually talking about making that rule standard at the end of this year to maybe come up with one number that's similar to both tours. So it's a little bit different there. With the shot clock idea, I guess a lot of times chair umpires use their discretion, as you know, and at the Australian Open, the time sometimes tends to be a little bit longer, but then the conditions are also a lot more difficult. Very hot, very humid, so difficult conditions for the player. So the chair umpire does have a little bit of discretion in terms of allowing them to go over the time a little bit. So I think once you take that out of the equation, it may become a little bit hard. If two players are playing at, you know, 25, 26, 27-second pace, both players are happy, I think it would be pretty difficult to try to, you know, put a clock in there. Imagine in the middle of the, you know, the service motion of the players getting ready, the shot clock goes off.
Yeah,
I think that would take away a lot from the game.
Yeah, it would seem like a little bit of a sideshow sort of thing, to, especially if you had an actual shot clock like you have in basketball.
Actually, yeah, that's one of the things that we've already discussed, is actually having a shot clock in the corner too, and then a buzzer going off or something like that. I think, you know, in terms of time saving in a whole match, it's not that much. So if you think about, you're maybe, you know, saving 1 or 2 seconds, you know, between each point, you're maybe talking about 3 or 4 minutes in a two-hour match. So I don't know whether it would make that big of a difference to implement the shot clocks. Most of the discussion centers around the fact that, you know, obviously, you know, television, which is a big aspect of it, you know, television wants to bring the match time down a little bit further, down a little bit further in order to fit into slots.
Yeah, my idea was to have, instead of having a shot clock that counted down, which, like I said, is a bit of a sideshow and sort of would be, I think, disruptive, if you could have a little light on the umpire's chair, which was green, and it would maybe turn red at the end of 25 or 30 seconds or something, it would be a little more discreet and not as distracting for the players and maybe even for the fans.
Well, it would help, obviously, to the chair umpire. The chair umpire does have, you know, as you know, the chair umpires use little PDAs on the chair. And as soon as the chair umpire enters a point, the stopwatch in the chair umpire's PDA resets to zero again. So they do have a clock in there built in, so they can see, you know, when the lights goes on and off. I think it's a little bit, you know, the chair umpire has to use their discretion. So if the line is, if the light goes red, is the chair umpire going to call a time violation? You know, that's going to be the interesting question. And at what stage do they call? Do they call it at 25, 26 seconds as a player is getting ready to serve? You know what I mean?
Right, exactly.
It becomes a little bit trickier. So right now we're left in the umpire's hands to kind of use their discretion in terms of how the flow of the match is going, whether it's just one player that's slowing down, whether it's both players slowing down, and then the chair umpire can speak to the players and hopefully deal with it that way rather than having a clock on the court, you know, lights and so forth. So really, if the chair umpire does his job properly, we should be able to, you know, to keep the time.
The famous Serena footfault call at the U.S. Open 2 years ago, it was 15:30 in a game that would be the match for Clijsters. A lineswoman called a footfault on a second serve. Do you think in a situation like that, because it was very crucial, obviously it really affected the match, do you think that maybe a linesperson in a situation like that should use a little discretion and maybe if she's just creeping over the line a little bit, let it go?
I guess in some ways, I guess I would ask you, the question is, if she did not call the footfault, let's say, and the replay showed that she did foot fault, what would they, you know, the TV commenters say at that stage now? Serena, you know, foot faulted, you know, serving 15:30. She wasn't get called on the foot fault. She would have lost the match, but now she wins the match.
Right.
So it's for line umpires especially, I think it's very, very dangerous to say use your discretion, because each official is a little bit different. So I think when it comes down to 15-30, 15-40, second serve, break points, you know, it's very, very difficult to tell line umpires to use their discretion because of the fact that, you know, no two umpires will have exactly the same kind of discretionary feelings that, you know, one has. So it might lead to inconsistencies in terms of how the rules are applied. So, you know, one of the things that players complain a lot about is the fact that they want officiating to be consistent. So if a line umpire sees a foot fault, you know, they should call a foot fault. Mm-hmm. You know, if you tell a line umpire, hey, if at 15-40 don't call the foot fault, then you're opening up a huge can of worms. And with the technology nowadays, with the, you know, close-up cameras and so forth, you cannot fault an umpire for calling a foot fault.
Right.
But you can definitely fault them for not calling a foot fault, because at a crucial stage they don't call a foot fault, and then it changes the match around.
Right.
So it's a very, very dangerous ground. So I think in any football situations, you know, we always tell umpires, listen, if you see a football, call the football. And unfortunately, you know, and the discussion is not whether she footfaulted or not. It's just a matter of the timing, I guess, right?
Right.
Because I think everyone knows that she footfaulted, and the umpire called the football.
Tony, can we talk dirty?
Not really, but...
Well, audible obscenities are part of the game, and players get warnings and penalties for them. What happens if those audible obscenities happen in a language that the umpire doesn't understand?
It happens a lot, actually. You know, as you know, we have you know, quite a few Russians, quite a few Spanish players, and they do swear a lot in their own languages. Actually, in Toronto, we had a couple of players swear in different languages as well, and we've actually fined those players as well. So chair umpires, most of the international chair umpires that travel the tour, they know pretty much all the swear words in pretty much every language or most common languages. So if they hear something, you know, or language that they understand, they're given a code violation, and the referee or supervisor will issue a fine based on, obviously, outside court, you know, main court, is there television, live television, several different factors will determine the amount of the fine. But we definitely don't allow any kind of audible obscenity in any language, not just English.
Right. And what's the most intimidating thing that's happened to you when you have to go out as a referee and make a ruling on a court in front of all the fans and in some difficult situation?
I think probably the most difficult situation is not naming obviously any specific players, as you know, I'm not going to mention any players. It's been a default situation, actually, exactly like you talked about. It's a foreign language. It was a chair umpire that spoke Russian, but he wasn't Russian, but he understands Russian. Player swore at the chair umpire in a foreign language in Russian, which the chair umpire understood. I was calling the court to make a decision on that, because if a player swears in Russian or whichever language, it just becomes a code violation, audible obscenity, a warning, or a point penalty. But if somebody swears directly at an official in whichever language, then it can be a default situation. I was calling the court on this situation. Chairman explained to me what happened, what the player had said, and it ended up me defaulting the player from the match.
So you weren't too popular with the player?
No. For many, many years.
Right. Was that a male or a female player? Just
a male
care?
Player.
A male player.
Yes.
Tony, you've traveled around the world a lot umpiring. Players, people in the media, officials like yourself have favorite tournaments. Which would you say you've enjoyed the most over the years?
Wow. Well, that's a tough one. I think, you know, as an official, you know, we kind of look at, you know, every match in essence the same, every tournament is the same. Obviously, you know, some tournaments are more difficult than others to officiate in or to referee in. But, you know, highlights, obviously, the Rogers Cup is, you know, it's close to the heart, obviously, because of the fact that I've been working there since 1986. I think I only missed a year or two when I was working for the ATP, and the women's event was in Toronto. I couldn't work it. But obviously, you know, tournament at home and, you know, Rogers Cup being, you know, what it is, I absolutely love the tournament, you know. Other highlights, you know, I've worked the Olympic Games in Barcelona, Spain, which was pretty special. But, you know, every tournament is great, you know. Everyone has his own challenges. You know, working in Italy and versus working in India is quite different, but both challenges and both interesting events.
So you're off to New Haven for the women's event right before the U.S. Open next week?
Yeah, correct, yes.
Well, Tony, we wish you a good tournament. We hope everything goes smoothly.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Tom Tebbett in conversation with Tony Cho, referee of the Rogers Cup. This segment of Aces is brought to you by Tennis Canada. To get up-to-the-minute tennis news and scores, visit lovemeansnothing.ca. Tennis is spoken here. And spoken on Aces, coming up, more tennis talk with Tom Tebbett and Roger Lajoie on Sportsnet Radio, The Fan 590. This is Aces on Sportsnet Radio, the Fan 590. I'm Roger Lajoie. Tom Tebbett along. Thanks for all of you for supporting the show throughout the course of the year, folks. We have Aces shows here on Sportsnet Radio, the Fan 590, coming up on September 1st and September 15th. Two more Thursdays, but we have some emails we've accumulated throughout the week, and Tom is going to answer your questions tonight, and in coming weeks we'll answer the questions. And Tom, we've had a lot of great tennis fans. It shows you the passion and depth of knowledge that tennis fans have about it. Every time we bring in the emails, we get great questions.
Yeah, we do, Raj, and a little bit scary. I tend to agree with almost all of them, so it doesn't make it very controversial. But
we may have some tonight that you disagree with.
Uh-oh.
We'll do our best on that, but roger@fan590.com is our email address. And listen, if you would like to email in and continue basis, because in the next 2 weeks, we're going to really concentrate on your questions for Tom. So many of you want to talk to Tom. If we don't get to it this week, we can get to it next week as well. Now, we've got another interview coming up before we get to the email box. Vasek Pospisil, tell us about him, Tom.
Well, Vasek, of course, had a great win at the Rogers Cup in Montreal last week. He beat world number 22, Juan Ignacio Chela. And then, of course, he played a guy named Roger Federer. And in the first set, the score was 5-5. So he acquitted himself very well, didn't seem to get too intimidated by the whole situation, and really was an impressive performance by him. Got him to number 145 in the world. That's in striking distance for sure of number 100. And you get around 100, 105, you get directly into Grand Slam tournament. So if Vasek has a good fall, he's in good shape.
Hey, that's a good stat, though. You mentioned that, Tom. Everybody says, well, what's the difference in performance? Talk to us a little bit about that, because the people who are not in tune to tennis don't realize the significance of a win for a guy like that.
Well, yeah, like it's got him to 145. And like I said, he's got a chance with some good results to get into maybe the Australian Open in January. In the meantime, he is playing the qualifying for the U.S. Open. So that'll be a chance to get directly in, but he'll have to win three matches. So get your ranking down, get in directly. It solves a lot of problems. It makes it a lot easier.
All right. Now here's Tom's conversation with Vasek Pospisil.
Vasek Pospisil, thanks for being with us tonight on Aces. And last week you had a terrific tournament in Montreal. You beat number 22 in the world. You moved into the top 150 for the first time, and you won your first ATP main draw match. How has that changed your life?
Oh, yeah, no, it was an incredible tournament for me. Obviously, it was my first ATP main draw, and to get a win against a top 30 player was huge for me, you know, just for confidence and overall. And I've been working hard all year, and I've been achieving my goals, and you know, being top 150 is one of them, so I'm happy with the way things are going.
When you were in that match with Chela, you were down 4-2 in the third set before coming back to win. How did you keep it together at that point?
Well, you know, I just tried to stay calm. Obviously, you know, given the opportunity, you don't want to throw it away and then kind of get down on yourself and not fight. So I knew he wasn't blowing me away with his serve, so I was just trying to really stay in there and wait for a few more chances to maybe break back and get back in the match. And so, you know, I had a chance and I took it, and I was I'm happy with the way I stayed calm and fought back.
And then obviously your next round you played against Roger Federer and had a solid performance. You lost 7-5, 6-3. Was it hard to get over the fact that you were playing a guy as great as him?
Well, yeah, I mean, well, for sure it's different, you know, it's a different feeling. Somebody that I've always looked up to, you know, growing up, and is kind of a guy that I've idolized and been my favorite player for years when I was a junior. So, yeah, you know, going to that match at first, you know, the first couple of games, I was maybe a little bit, you know, nervous and stuff, but I did well to kind of block out the occasion and my opponent and try to concentrate on just my own game. So overall, I thought I did well to do that and played pretty well.
You practiced with Federer, I guess, at the 2008 Australian Open before he played his semifinal. Would he have remembered you? Had you seen him at all before you actually played him last week?
Yes, well, actually, since then, we always kind of say hi to each other, you know, every Rogers Cup when I see him and a few of the slams. We know each other, and I've you know, we've crossed paths and we've talked a bit in the players' lounges over the years. So yeah, he knows who I am.
You know, those were good wins. Obviously, the win against Chela and then the great match against Federer. Would you watch those matches on videotape just to see what happened?
Yeah, for sure. No, I have them on tape already, and I'm gonna look over them in the near future with my coach Fred Niemeyer. So yeah, no, for sure, those are good. Good tapes to have, good things to see, you know, things that I need to improve, things that I'm doing well, seeing what I'm hurting my opponents with. And so I'll definitely take those tapes and analyze those few matches.
I wrote a story on you when you were 9 years old and you won a tournament in San Diego. I mean, it's been a long road since then. But what would you say were, I know it's hard to just name a couple of things, but what would be the main steps in the progression you've made in the last 12 years?
Oh, well, you know, there have been a lot of steps. There have been a lot of steps that we've made, that my family's made, a lot of sacrifices. A big step we made since then was going to Europe to train in the summer, you know, on clay with really good players pretty much every summer since I was 12 or so. And, you know, and then it's just now we made a good step, obviously, to you know, switch make a bit of change with the coaching. And now I'm working with Fred Niemeyer and part of the NTC program, and that's going really well. So I'm really happy with, in general, the way things are going and the decisions my father and I have made over the years.
Obviously, last month you played Davis Cup in Guayaquil, Ecuador, and you lost your first match, but after that you were fantastic. You won your doubles with Daniel Nestor, and then you won the fourth match against their top player. What's different about playing Davis Cup when you're playing for your country?
Oh, yeah. I mean, no, Davis Cup, it's something really special, obviously. You know, it's another one of those things that you kind of dream of. You always want to represent your country and play for your country. So for me, that was a pretty amazing experience. And to come back after that first day where I didn't really play my best, and I really bounced back and thought I played really well the next two matches, especially the last day of singles. So, yeah, I mean, just that was a huge confidence boost. I think also, you know, just to help the team come back like that, and you know, it really helped me for the next tournaments.
When you play in South America or when you play Davis Cup, especially when you play away, obviously there's a bit of a hostile crowd. Were there any memories you have of playing in Ecuador and some of the things that you had to overcome?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, it's I guess any crowd in South America can be a little hostile sometimes. But, you know, there's the occasional, like, the heckling and stuff like that. But that's all kind of stuff that you try to block out. And I did a good job doing that, too, I think. Well, especially... as the weekend went on, you know, at first maybe it's something you're not too used to. But yeah, like as the weekend went on, it got better and better, I thought, for the way I was handling it at least.
Canada now plays Israel, I think it's the 15th to the 18th of September in Tel Aviv or near Tel Aviv, and a chance to move up to the World Group. How do you size that up?
Oh, I know. We're all excited about that. You know, I think, you know, we've been given a great opportunity. We've gotten far now, and it'd be great for us to qualify, and we're all pretty we're feeling good about it. You know, we all believe that we can win, and obviously it'd be great to have Milos back, who's been out for some weeks now. So you know, we're all excited for that, and you know, we like our chances. We think we can do well there.
You played doubles with Daniel in the tie in Ecuador, and what's it like playing with a guy who's that good?
Oh, well yeah, I mean, he's another one of those players that I you know, doubles being a big part of my career, you know, one of those guys I've always looked up to as well. So, you know, playing with him was maybe a little bit of extra pressure because, you know, you don't want to lose with a guy like that who basically doesn't lose doubles matches. So, but I mean, it was pretty amazing. It was pretty awesome. I've always wanted to play side by side with him. And so that was another one of those kind of dream come true kind of type moments. So, no, yeah, it was great.
You won your match against Chela on the National Bank Court right beside the Uniprix Stadium in Montreal. 2 years ago, Milos had a fantastic match there against Fernando Gonzalez. Were you there for that match? Do you remember it?
I was in Montreal, but I was not at the court or at the site. I was actually in my hotel.
Oh, I see. Now, because you played on the same court, and it was kind of, in a way, a breakthrough match for Milos, even though he didn't win it, to play against the number 10 player in the world and play that well. I think it maybe helped him in terms of his confidence.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, you know, it did definitely brought up some flashbacks. I mean, the atmosphere was incredible for Milos' match, because I saw a bit of it on TV and some of the highlights, and then for my match, it was you know, just as awesome. So yeah, for sure, it would be great if you know, I feel like that match could be kind of a turning point for me. Obviously, I've gained a lot of confidence over the last few weeks, so. I like the way you know my game is going right now, and I'm just going to keep working hard and kind of try to get to the top 100 very soon.
In May, you won a tournament in Korea, and you won all five of your matches against players from Asia. And of course, you know, people here see the result and think that's great that Bashak has won a tournament and getting. I think you got 27 points, and you won $1,950 and everything. But what do you remember from a tournament like that? Things that we would never hear about in terms of, you know, the guys you played against, what the city was like, your accommodation, the tourist stuff, just little things that you remember about a tournament like that, which would be very obscure for a lot of people who are back here in Canada.
Well, you know, it's going to a tournament like that, I didn't really know what to expect. Obviously, I've never been to, well, I've been to Asia once before that, but it was for a bigger challenger event. So I wasn't really sure of the level of play over there, but I was quite surprised actually at how good these guys play. You know, they don't really travel much. They don't travel out of Asia, out of their country. So I think that was probably the one thing that struck me the most over there. But you know, like little things like I guess diet and the food. You know, it's just all new experiences for me that I'm not used to at all, that took a bit getting used to.
This is a bit of an obvious question to ask, and I've never heard you called this, but I'm sure you're called Popsicle now and then, and do you like that, or does it bug you?
No, it doesn't really bug me. It's kind of funny because people always think they're the first ones to call me that when they do, but I get that a lot, for sure. I get that a lot. Pretty much everywhere I go, at least one person will call me Popsicle and think it's the funniest thing, but you know, it's good fun. It's you know, I don't mind it at all.
And you're in Montreal now training for the qualifying, I guess, for the U.S. Open, which will be next week. What kind of things are you doing, and what are you thinking about looking ahead to the qualifying at the U.S. Open? How much of a challenge do you think it'll be?
Well, yeah, I took a couple of days off to rest up because I had a long summer, and now, you know, I'm working really hard the last couple of days, and up until Friday, I go to New York on Friday, and you know, I'm really looking forward to it. Obviously, I feel like I'm playing good tennis right now, my goal is definitely to qualify, having said that, it won't be easy. You know, goal is one thing, but there's some really good players in the qualifying event, so. So I'll just try to go there and take it one match at a time and have a good preparation here in Montreal and just see how it goes over there.
Well, listen, we wish you the best of luck in the U.S. Open qualifying, and thanks a lot for being on Aces tonight.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks, guys.
Well, Tom, that's an interesting guy. No question about it. What a significant win for him.
Yeah, it was funny when he played Federer after the match. Federer kept talking about how tall he was, and he'd seen him before the match. He's so tall, he's so tall. Well, he does have a good serve, and he has a very good inside-out forehand, which is a shot a lot of players have nowadays, because it allows you, usually, if you're playing a right-hander, to drill the ball into their backhand and, you know, do some damage there. So, and he also is a good volleyer. He really has an all-round game. So I think there's a really good upside to Vasek.
Interesting guy. Tom Tebbit's an interesting guy, and you have a lot of interesting questions for him on email. We're going to get to the email box next. Roger Lajoie, Tom Tebbit, you're listening to Aces. This segment of Aces is brought to you by Corona Extra. Pick up your 6-packs of new Corona Extra limited edition bottles at the LCBO and the beer store. Visit findourbeach.ca to vote for your favorite bottle. Tom's email box is next on Sportsnet Radio, The Fan 590.
Make your friends weep with envy. Win wicked prizes inside the fan club. Join today at fan590.com.
You're listening to Aces on Sportsnet Radio, The Fan 590. I'm Roger Lajoie, Tom Tebbit alongside, as we have been on Thursday nights throughout the course of the tennis season. And thanks so much for your support, fans. We've had so many people calling in, emailing throughout the weeks we've been on. We have two more Thursday nights coming up, Thursday, September the 1st and Thursday, September the 15th. And we're going to check the email box right now. Roger at fan590.com. And if you're listening in and would like the email and you have a question for Tom, we have the two more weeks. We'll continue to collect them, and your thoughts are great. And Tom, we talk about the educated tennis fan. We were talking about it earlier in the show. These people are great. The passion for tennis in this country is great. And it's really just a lot of fun to be involved with the show, because you see it more often than I do, but I see the passion of tennis fans in this country.
Well, no, you know, you like to see people playing on the courts. I know when I travel around the city or go anywhere else, you always see a park. And, is anybody playing there? If you go to a club, you know, lots of people keeping the courts busy. And I think actually tennis is on the upswing. I was talking to some equipment people recently, and some of the figures are very promising. So, you know, good news for tennis.
Now, do you see a benefit long-term in terms of people buying tennis tickets in correlation to people playing the sport, Tom?
That's a funny one, Rog, because there's often a bit of a, you know, tennis is going to an event like the Rogers Cup is a little bit like going to the theater.
Yeah.
If it's, you know, Federer's there, if Nadal's there, if Serena Williams is there,
you're going to go whether you're playing the sport or not.
Yeah, man. I mean, you might go to the Canadian Open Golf because Tiger Woods is there or because Phil Mickelson's there or something like that. So there's not necessarily correlation, but there's certainly a lot of people who are at tennis tournaments who play tennis.
Yeah, and a lot of people go to Blue Jay games and not baseball players either. So it does. The correlation isn't necessarily there, but I think the casual, the more people that are picking up rackets, Tom, the better it is for the sport. I don't think there's any question about that. Let's get to the email box at roger@fan590.com. Lots of questions for Tom and Tom's email bag. I just came up with the name of that myself. What do you think?
Well, have we patented it, Rog? I mean, I don't know.
You know, I can't use that. Yeah, we need a copyright. I got to talk to my legal people.
No, I've got a lawyer too, Rog.
Uh-oh. That's bad news. This segment of ACES, by the way, whatever we're calling it, is brought to you by National Bank Financial Group. Need a smarter mortgage? All-in-one banking from National Bank gives you highly competitive mortgage rates, plus a line of credit. For details, visit nbc.ca/all-in-one. All right, Tom, let's get to it. So many listeners want to email in. Rick's a regular listener to the show and enjoying it. Rick, thank you very much. He wants to talk to Tom about the best players in the history of the game. Right now, the men's side, says Rick, there are three great players, Tom, as we all know, but where do you rank those gentlemen compared to Rod Laver, John Newcomb, some of the all-time greats? Are we really seeing the best men's tennis players of all time? That's a great question. Where do they rank with the older guys, Tom?
Well, it's a little bit hard to figure out. I guess I have a top five, which would be Laver, Sampras, Borg, Federer, and Pancho Gonzalez.
Well, you've got a mix then of eras there for sure.
Yeah, so you obviously, one of the three people we talked about is there already because he's won more Grand Slams than anybody else. I think Nadal is certainly closing in at 10 Grand Slams and 6 French Opens and just the variety showed by being able to win Wimbledon as well. So I don't know. He's probably not maybe 7-8, but he could be in the top 10 of all time, certainly in the top 15. As far as Djokovic goes, it's just a little premature, but if he can win the U.S. Open, he'll have to start piling them up after that. But if he can win the U.S. Open, the year he's had this year is maybe the best one any player's ever had, although it's hard to say that when Rod Laver won all four twice and Don Budge did the same thing. But with the changes of surface now and all that stuff, what Djokovic has done so far, as I say, especially if he can win the U.S. Open, is something really nobody's ever done.
Now, is tennis the same as golf? And you just pretty much said it, but I'll ask it anyway. Does it really correlate to the number of majors? Because in golf, it's all about, people talk about Woods, Nicklaus. When you talk about the all-time greats, they're defined by the major tournaments. Is tennis the same thing, or is there something to be said for longevity? Although I guess they go hand in hand, Tom.
Well, they do. I think, you know, you have to go by the numbers. And Federer, when he, you know, passed Emerson at 12 and Sampras at 14, then that did it. But on the women's side, if you look at it, it's sort of interesting. Margaret Court won 22. And about half of those were at the Australian Open, because she was Australian, and there weren't really good fields then, and not many people went. Then you have Helen Wills, who was 19, Chris Everett and Navratilova at 18, and then you go all the way down to 13 for Serena. But on the other hand, you watch Serena play sometimes, and watch her obviously play at the Rogers Cup, and I think at her best, I just don't really see a Navratilova, an Everett, or a Graf even having, well, they'd have a good match against her, but Serena's just got such a great all-around game, such a fantastic serve, and on top of everything, she's probably the best fighter I've ever seen. Her competitive drive is just, I think she does scare a lot of players now, and I think she'd scare other ones. She's just so tough that I think it would be, even though she only has 13, she's in the equation for the best player ever.
There's no doubt about that, and you talk about both Serena and Venus. They were intimidation, especially when they were at the top of their games, both of them for sure. Thanks for that email. Roger@fan590.com is the email address for ACES, and you can email us anytime. As like we said, Tom will have more time to answer your questions on both the 1st and the 15th of September coming up. Steve's another regular listener to the show. We've got so many, and Steve, thank you. And Steve says, Tom, I was very interested in your comment about Monday night as perhaps being a time to showcase tennis, i.e. the end of a tournament happening on Monday. I'm a big tennis fan, but it's hard for me to get the remote from the wife, who likes other sports. His wife likes sports. Man, I like this guy. On Sundays, there's lots of baseball, NFL, all the reasons. Why doesn't tennis really look at that? Look what Monday Night Football did for the NFL. And Tom, do you think tennis is missing the boat by not trying to create its own time? I'd never thought of that until you mentioned it a couple of weeks ago, Tom, but the more and more I like that. Is it logistics, travel, TV? Why haven't they pursued that?
Well, it's a lot of things, I think. Actually, next year, we are going to have a Monday night final in Montreal for the women's event. But that's directly related to the fact the Olympics are finishing the week before our tournament starts.
Okay, so it's a once-in-a-lifetime problem.
So we're going to stagger an extra day before the women start, and then they'll finish on the Monday just to make it a little bit easier. But I think, for example, I think we have tried to get a Monday final for the men's event, especially now that they're virtually combined tournaments, and they're in the same week with the women. So it would be nice if you could have the tournaments go over to a Monday. But, for example, in the negotiations with Cincinnati, if we went to a Monday, the following tournament would have to go to a Monday as well. And Cincinnati, I think, is largely hesitant about going to the Monday because they have a contract with CBS to show a Sunday final. And CBS are probably not going to show a Monday final in prime time at night. So,
gotcha.
And also, there's another problem, too, is if you have a night final, say, starting at 7 or 8 o'clock, then in Europe, and you're trying to have an audience over there, they're in the middle of the night. So there's lots of complications. But I love night tennis, as tough as it is when you're writing for a newspaper on deadline. Causes a lot of problems. But, you know, the atmosphere at the Australian Open at night, the atmosphere at the U.S. Open at night is terrific.
Another emailer, Al, and another regular listener to the show, Al, we appreciate, wants to talk about Canadian tennis. It's a long email, but I'll try to give you the Reader's Digest. He talks about Ronich. He talks about his emergence as a big Canadian star. But, Tom, what about the other Canadian players? Who do you think is the next big thing, either on the male or female side, and gets into talking about a lot of them? What about the rest of Canada's content? Ronich gets all the pub.
Yeah, well, I mean, we talked to Vasek Pospisil tonight, so I think he's in there right now, probably is the most promising of the young players. Philip Bester played extremely well in Davis Cup, and, you know, he has an upside as well, but he's been injured for the last, say, month or so. And Peter Polanski's had a groin injury, it's just hung around for the longest time, so that's tricky. Frank Dancevic's going through a difficult time getting a little bit older. Hopefully he can get it back together, but he lost a match at Wimbledon when he had match points, and that was kind of discouraging for him. So I think Vasek is right there, and obviously Milos on the women's side. Rebecca Marino, I think, is our most promising player. She's been doing very well. And this is an older player now because she's coming back from a forearm injury that kept her out for a lot of the last year. But Alexandra Wozniak has won a tournament in Vancouver, won a round against Shahar Peer, the Rogers Cup last week. And I wouldn't be surprised if she's back in the top 50 very soon.
That's Tom Tebbett. I'm Roger Lajoie. You're listening to Aces on Sportsnet Radio, the Fan 590. We're checking the email box at roger@fan590.com. Time for a couple more, and we encourage you to continue emailing because Tom and I will take your emails again on our shows on the 1st and the 15th. Tim comes in, another long email, but he talks about great disappointments over the many years you've covered tennis. Mr. Tebbett, I don't get that one, but anyway, Mr. Tebbett, how about players who have been big disappointments? I'm concerned that if Ronich doesn't develop into the player, we'll consider him a disappointment, but he mentioned guys like Andy Roddick, Monfils, some other guys. Like, are there guys that maybe, you know, over your course of your career, Tom, have you thought about and said, geez, you know, he never became the player I thought he was going to be?
Not as many come to mind as I like. I mean, Andy Roddick, I think, is hard to be hard on him because I just don't think he's quite that good a player. He just came along, snuck in there, won a Grand Slam before Federer and Nadal came along. He's just not as good
as
them.
Tough era, too, to play in with those guys. How many majors are you going to win with those guys playing at the same time?
Well, exactly. So, I mean, I think some people sort of wrongly, because he won one young in his early in his career, that they expected more, but I think it was bad sort of timing. Looking at the other players, it's hard to say. I mean, Marcelo Rios, the player from Chile, he was a mini McEnroe, really, really talented player. Maybe he felt, because he was undersized, small, he had a bit of a complex or something, but he definitely should have won a Grand Slam at some point. And other players, just at the moment, unfortunately, not too many come to mind. But in the current game, there's a guy named Ernest Gulbis from Latvia. And we all just watch him play. And the force of his striking the ball is just amazing. He's 6'3", he's got a huge serve, does everything right. But he's a head case. And Monfils, I think, is more of an entertainer. I think we talked about him in the last show. I think he may have jumped the shark in terms of ever winning a Grand Slam, but he sure as heck is fun to watch because he's such a great athlete.
Roger@fan590.com is email box. Tom and I will take your emails in future weeks. Quickly, Tom, the Rogers Cup is in the bag, but we still have two shows. You're off to the U.S. Open, then to Israel.
That's right. I'll be going to the U.S. Open at the end of next week, I guess, and it starts on the 29th. And then the Canadian Davis Cup team plays in Israel from the 16th to the 18th of September with a chance to get in the World Group for next year. So that'll be very exciting. And in the meantime, we'll be looking forward to next Thursday. They'll be doing the draw for the U.S. Open. So the hardcore fans there will want to follow everything right from the very beginning. And actually the qualifying, and Vasek Pospisil will be playing. I think Alexander Wozniak will be playing and a couple other Canadians. That starts on Tuesday the 23rd.
All right. And we'll have another show on the 1st of September and the 15th. Roger@fan590.com. Tom will answer more of your questions. We didn't get to all emails, but we'll get to more. Email us anytime. Roger@fan590.com. Tom, you're a good man. We'll talk to you from New York City next, I guess.
Mr. Lajoie, It was a pleasure.
All right, sir. Thank you. Likewise. Tom Tebbett, Roger Lajoie. Thanks to Joe Sicilia, Josh Goldsmith for helping out, Lance Candy as well in producing Aces this week. We'll be back September 1st and the 15th. Email us anytime at roger@fan590.com. You've been listening to Aces, Canada's only tennis show on Sportsnet Radio, The Fan 590.